Pittsburgh, I love ya. This is Brian Edward, and you're listening to Berg Vivant, Pittsburgh's cultural talk magazine, delivered digitally, straight up, shaken, and stirred. Tonight's broadcast brought to you by our spectacular sponsors and strategic partners, Zafalo's Banquet and Event Center, Carnegie, Pennsylvania, one of the most beautiful and unique venues in the greater Pittsburgh area for weddings, corporate dinners, fundraisers, and more. Visit clubzafalo.com. Off the Wall Theater, enlivening, educating, and entertaining audiences in the Pittsburgh region. View their current season at insideoffthewall.com. Arcade Comedy Theater, hosting local and national comedians, sketch comedy, improv, and more. 811 Liberty Avenue, downtown. Be sure to like them on Facebook or find them at arcadecomedytheater.com. Berg Vivant is a proud supporter of Firefly Arts, creating opportunities and support for families living with autism through innovative arts programming. You can learn more and show your support at fireflyarts.org. Director Michael Licata. It sounds like a Broadway name. Do you know what I mean?
Well, Licata, thank you. That's a first time I've ever heard that.
Really? I was going to ask. It's either that or like the special at Mama Lucia's, I guess.
Well, it could be that. There's a little fishing village city in southern Sicily called Licata. And if you look in the phone book there, it's Licata in Licata is like Smith anywhere in the United States. There's just pages and pages of Licata.
All right. Well, you're not nearly as interesting as I thought. Okay, moving on. But you do have some Broadway experience.
Yes.
So you're no stranger to that. Mm-hmm. A professional actor for around about 25 years.
Yeah.
Am I rounding up? Am I rounding down?
You're actually, it's closer to 30. It's somewhere in between, but I'm not going to take the time to try to figure it out right now because my brain doesn't work.
Let's go with 25.
Well, let's say 25. It's a nice round number.
Yeah. And then pretty much became a full-time director after that point.
That's right. I made the transition probably about, let's see, we're in what, 2000? 15 now. So I made the transition about 16 or 17 years ago.
So what happened? They just run out of roles for dashing men with salt and pepper hair?
No. Well, it wasn't salt and pepper back then. This came with the directing in the last two or three
you
years.
You earned it.
It's interesting. I think I made more money as an actor than I do as a director, but I didn't enjoy it as much as I do directing. My mind works more like a director than an actor. When I first got the opportunity to direct, it was like somebody put a pair of shoes on that really, really fit well.
Wow. Okay.
And there was a period where I was going. I was working as an actor, doing regional theater, a couple of national tours, and then I just started getting more jobs as a director. So directors tend to book a little more in advance than actors. So it was really hard to start, to go to this audition. Well, I've got this job and it conflicts. And yeah, it's a national tour and it might pay me a lot of money, but I really, at that age, wanted to do what I really enjoyed doing. And
well,
I do enjoy that.
Then I support this decision.
Yes.
100%.
Yeah.
Finding that your mind worked more as a director, was it difficult for you to leave that behind? Do you act at all these days?
I haven't acted on stage in over 10 years, and that was only somebody twisted my arm. But when I say my mind thinks like a director, this is my own perception, my opinion. But an actor is very inside out. In order to be successful as an actor, they have to really look at everything around them through their eyes. As an actor, that was really, really difficult for me. I was always pulling myself out and looking at the whole picture. And, when I couldn't sleep, well, why don't I do it this way? And it was just really hard for me. That's why I think I felt like I was putting the right pair of shoes on. But that's what I mean. That's where my brain and consequently when I work with really good actors and I sense that inside out, that for lack of a better word, narcissism maybe a little bit, I love it. I think that's great. I think there's a line in Chorus Line where they say, "Dance for grandma, dance for grandma." And I like to say when I'm working with a really good actor, when I see a really good actor, whether they're 2 years old or whether they're 90 years old, I see a little kid standing on the dining room table dancing for grandma and aunts and uncle, and they have to do that. I didn't have to do that. I'm the one that wants to say, get up on the table and do this. So that's what I mean, where my brain went, I think, goes there.
Now, it seems to me that directors a lot of times are unsung heroes. Like, to reference Wizard of Oz, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. I think they get a lot of attention if the show doesn't do well, but when it's great,
blamed for everything.
You know, they want us, oh, the acting, the set and everything, because it's tough sometimes. I think when you're seeing a show, I mean, you clearly see, you know, you can see a good actor, you can see a great set design, but when you see a show, what do you feel is the mark in a production of a great director?
Well, it's going to sound like a cliche that everything just comes together and fits. Nothing stands out as being too good, nothing stands out as being too bad. It's all one thing, and you follow the story, and when you walk out of the theater, you've been affected, not by, oh, it's great to be affected by an actor's performance, it's great to say that was an absolutely beautiful set, but if there's something that the writers intended the audience to feel when they walked out of the theater, if the audience feels that, then I think the director has done his job.
Mm-hmm.
And not everybody realizes that. That's okay. I mean, yeah, of course you want a pat in the back every now and then, but I'm past that.
Oh, come on.
No, really, honestly, there's nothing. People would say that, like when I was, somebody said, don't you want to be up there with them? And I said, no, there's nothing better than sitting down and looking at something and saying, well, they may not know that, but I put that up there. I mean, you didn't put it up there by yourself. You know, collaboration is this whole business. That's the name of the game, but I don't miss it at all.
Mm-hmm. There's, I think, a lot of psychology to it, too, in working with actors, which are people, and every one of them's different.
That's very true.
And has different ways of working. How do you handle a difficult actor?
Well, if I find out they're difficult before I hire them, I don't hire them.
Yeah, that but, easily dealt with.
But it's just, it's like being a psychologist. You just have to know the right, every person is different, and every actor, whether they're, I don't want to say difficult, but maybe a little more needy, they're everybody is different, and you just have to try to figure out how to work with them to get the best possible work.
I once heard said of directing for the stage that one of the most brilliant things a director can do is get an actor to do something in such a way that they feel like they came up with it on their own. What do you think of that?
That's completely, not just with directors, with designers, with everybody. I mean, you're dealing with artists, and you figure out a way to, I think that's exactly right. I've just never heard it put quite that way, but I like that.
Feel free to use that. I don't know if it's mine. I mean, clearly not, because I heard it somewhere, but that stuck with me.
I'll say sometimes, if somebody will say, oh, can I try to do this here, and they do it, and it really works, I'll say, gee, I'm really glad I thought of that.
Well, good. See, you're taking those pats on the back, even if you have to give them to yourself. There you go. So you are here with us in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. Welcome back. I think you've visited us before.
When I was an actor, I came through a few times on the road. I think it was Heinz Hall. Worked once for Civic Light Opera back in the early 90s. But I've been here, but never an extended time, you know, maybe a week at a time, 2 weeks or something like that.
Are you enjoying your stay?
I love this city. I absolutely love Pittsburgh. I don't know why. I just didn't expect it to be as cosmopolitan as it is. What I really love about it is the importance that arts and culture seems to be.
Oh my, yes.
I mean, isn't there something called the cultural
district?
Not just that, but there's a whole organization, I think, that cultural
trust.
Trust, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is what a unique idea.
And you can trust and you culture can trust here. You can believe in
here.
It.
And I know a lot of actor friends who live here. I mean, they can really make a living, and that's really cool. That's It's not like that everywhere.
No, we have a great company. We are at Pittsburgh Musical Theater right now. You know how I know is they posted on the wall for me. Otherwise, would completely lose it. But you are directing Peter Pan for PMT.
Yeah.
Are we flying in this show? Yeah? It's tough to have Peter Pan and not fly, right?
But it's been done.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been done successfully, I understand. It just, you know, it's a different concept. But yes, Peter flies.
Does that make you nervous?
No, I've done the show before. I know it. I just did Mary Poppins, and
you were a great Peter Pan. Yes. I must say.
No, I was the director.
I know.
Although,
let's clarify that for anybody that doesn't get my humor.
Yeah, I did play. Although there have been some directors that have played their own Peter Pan. There's a book out called "Who Dropped Peter Pan" or something. I don't know if you ever have a chance. Google it tonight. It's really fun.
I'm going to read it after I see PMT's show.
It's really fun, and it's actually it's not a true story, but it's fiction based a little bit on fact, but it's fun. So
you've got a great crew to be working with for this. Wonderful
great
cast.
And good people, really good people.
You got Tim Hartman, right? Is he Captain Hook?
He's Captain Hook and Mr. Darling.
Wow. Oh, the sort of dual universe
it's
thing.
It's done like that a lot. He's tremendous.
And Quinn Shannon is Smee, right?
Yeah.
I just worked with these clowns in Young Frankenstein
last month.
So, yeah, you got your hands full there, buddy.
Hey, you know what? They make my job really, really easy. They're just so much fun. I just love to just, you know, that's what a director loves is, okay, this is what I'd like to see. Do it, and they do it, and they're great. They're good people.
So you've been given a show that, you know, if we have not seen on stage, we all certainly know the story.
Definitely.
It's been around for a couple of years.
Do you know what I found out? What I was researching, that actually it was the play came first, and then the novel.
Oh.
Now you would think it was the other way around, but
yes.
The play was very successful, and Jan Barry wrote a novel, and then he added on to it. There's like 10 different books. But it's been since the early 1900s, I think.
I did not know that, that the play came first. Well, that's a triumph for the theater, I would say. But for those of us who are very familiar of it, you know, well, even for you, in you know, being asked to direct a piece that's so familiar, how do you approach that? Do you put a concept on it, or what is your approach to this?
Well, concept. Really, the story is so good and so strong, and this particular piece is so strong that it kind of does itself. And you really, what makes each version different is the creative people that you are working with. This is completely different, although it's the same production I did, 2007, I think, something like that. It'll be a completely different production because it's a completely different group of actors. It's a different scenic designer, a different theater. So I think it's a great story. You don't really want to, if it's not broken, don't fix it as far as the story is concerned. I've heard there are versions out there that are very conceptual. Well, the Star Peter and the Starcatcher is, but that's not Peter Pan. There's another version that comes from London, I think. It's a small version that where they don't fly, but they lift the actors.
They don't fly? Peter Pan doesn't fly?
Well, they fly, but the flying is done by actors
running like this with their arms in front of them.
That's what I've heard. I've not seen it. But, you know, it's one of those things that it's a great story, a universal story. People love it, so we just do what they wrote.
Why does Captain Hook hate Peter Pan?
That's a good question. Well, he hates women, although Peter is a boy, but he I think it's about the fact
that he knows Peter's played by a woman?
No. I didn't say Peter was played by a woman, Dan.
Oh, no, really? Who's playing Peter Pan in this production?
Michelle Cole.
Okay, there you go.
So, yes. But no, he's got this real thing against women. Because he never had a mother. I don't want to say, his whole thing is the reason he hates Peter Pan so much in this version is Peter has the mother. He has Wendy. Wendy becomes his mother. And he wants, because somewhere along the line in Captain Hook's background, he had a bad experience with his mother. He also hates children, I think. You should probably ask the actor playing that.
Yeah,
role.
Well, no, this is getting deep and sad.
Well, there is a little, although this is just a lot of fun, but why does he hate children so much? Because he's the villain. That's why he hates children so much.
The other thing I always wondered is if his birth name was Hook, and it was just a wonderful coincidence that he ended up with a hook for a hand.
Yeah, that is a wonderful coincidence. Never really thought of that.
Come on, get with it. You open in like a week,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, that's really good, right? Well, he does have a hook for a hand. I'll talk to Tim about that.
Discuss. That would be a very good meeting.
About that.
But we at Berg Vivant are really looking forward to it. I mean, PMT has delivered a lot of great shows this year, and this is certainly going to be the icing on the cake.
Well, it's really, I'm honored to be a part of this, because one thing about Pittsburgh is I feel like it's got this direct pipeline to successful show business people. I mean, mm-hmm. just, you know, Gene Kelly born here. And, there's, I saw the list this morning, but I know I've worked with Rob Marshall and Kathy and Rob Ashford and great schools, Carnegie, Point Park, this organization.
The Klondike Bar was invented here. I'm just going to
add
that to your list there.
I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. But to feel like I'm a part of these up-and-coming people that I fully expect to hear and see wonderful things in the future, I love that, and I'm honored to do it, and it's really a lot of fun.
Oh, you will, yeah. PMT is like a factory. I mean, they make stars. This is a star mm-hmm. factory. Peter and the Star Factory.
Yeah.
But you're no stranger to some big names. You've worked with some really interesting people in your career.
I've been very lucky, very, very lucky.
Because you've lived to tell about it.
I've lived to tell about it, but I had the honor, privilege of working with Bob Fosse.
Wow.
1986 revival of Sweet Charity.
Wow.
On Broadway and on the road. I was the Oscar and Vittorio standby or understudy. Plus, I was also in the show. Wasn't in the show until the second act. I was in Rhythm of Life, and then I Love to Cry at Weddings. But I covered like a lot of the speaking roles. You know, I would the policeman. But one, if you're interested in an interesting little story.
Of course.
Debbie Allen opened the show on Broadway. This was 1986. She was, you probably weren't even born yet.
I was. Why am I proud of that? But I was.
Well, she was the original Charity, and she was in it for probably 6 months, and then she had film commitments or television commitments, and she left, and they brought in Anne Reinking to play Charity. Now, so when they were putting her into the show, rehearsing Anne, about 6 weeks it took them to put her into the show, they decided to bring an actor in to work with her, because I knew Vittorio and I knew Oscar. I also knew Dark Glasses. So those are the three love interests.
So when you say, I'm assuming it was you that was the actor that they brought in?
Yeah, I was the actor they brought in.
Whoa.
And you know, just a little side note there, when I've directed the show a number of times, I've a couple of times actually combined all those three roles. But anyway, so I was the understudy, and they said, well, we'll bring you in, and you'll work. So Anne would be able to work with somebody who kind of could say the lines okay, and instead of just a stage manager, you know. So it was great. I mean, I'd come in, rehearsal come in at 10 o'clock, and from 10 to 1, I'd work with Gwen Verdon, who was assisting Bob at the same time.
That's right, yeah.
And Anne, and then there was a stage manager and an assistant stage manager and a couple of dance captains. Cy Coleman would come in to work with her. It was really great. And we'd work in the morning, and then Bob would come in after lunch and look at what we'd done and change everything, you know. And Gwen would go, oh, but they're supposed to do it like this. And Bob said, yeah, but they're different people. Let them do it their way, which was really interesting. Anyway, so I was the best prepared understudy on Broadway.
Well, in that company, I would be, yeah.
But so one day, I got to set the scene. It's late fall. It's gray. You know how it is when the little snowflakes start to come down. We're at the Minskoff Rehearsal Studios, which is on Schubert Alley. And we were in the corner studio. I think this is where MTV or Alvin Ailey now is. I'm not sure. It's in that Minskoff mm-hmm. building. So we're in the corner office, or the corner rehearsal studio, huge, like, two-floor windows. You're overlooking Sardi's. You're overlooking the Schubert Theater where Chorus Line was playing, and we're doing this scene where the movie star scene, and Vittorio Vidal is sitting at the at this like bar in the apartment, and Charity starts talking, and she picks up an olive, and she puts it in her mouth and starts talking, and then she realizes the pit's in her mouth, and she pulls out and goes, scusi, and she puts it in an ashtray. Well, she wasn't quite doing what Bob wanted her to do, and we kept doing it, and we kept doing it, and we kept doing it. And finally she just stopped. She goes, Bobby, I can't do this anymore. I can't play this part. I can't get this moment. I'm not going to be able to do it. I don't know what to do. I'm not going to be able to do it. And you look over in the corner, and there's Gwen sitting next to the mirror, and she's going, Annie, it's okay. I had the same problem with that moment. And she was in tears. So here's Ann in tears and Gwen in tears. And Bob is sitting there, and his glasses are hanging down here. And at that time, you could smoke in a studio.
Yeah, yeah.
A cigarette out of his mouth, and the ashes were on the lenses. And he's just kind of just, you know, like this. And I'm sitting there watching this whole thing. And I think Cy Coleman was over there that morning sitting there. And I just thought, my God, if I die today, I've experienced
That was like Broadway gold.
This moment, yeah, it was one. I just was so God, I'm so lucky that I got to experience this.
So you kept that olive pit, right? As a souvenir.
I should have, but I didn't. So.
Gosh, I do enjoy a good Fosse story, yeah. And usually the ones I hear are people were terrified of him.
I think he was, you know, it was unfortunately this was close to the end of his life, because he. I think it was maybe less than a year later, he died in Washington. I was in that company. But I found him to be very mellow, very, very encouraging to everybody. He really wanted it his way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and he was always right. It impressed me so much as I look back and I was absorbing all these things that I would absorb to be a director, how during the tech rehearsals in New York, you know, there was this big tech table, and all these people were sitting around him, and it was what he wanted. It was, you know, the cowbell. I just never forget the cowbell. In the Frug, the cowbell wasn't right, and he just didn't. You know, they just kept going. No, sent somebody out down to Sam Ash or something, the music store, and came back with a cowbell.
Oh, it was the cowbell's fault, actually.
Well, they just didn't have the sound that he wanted,
huh.
And you know, I never saw any temperament. Like I said, it was later in his life, but that just really impressed me that, you know, he got what he wanted, and it was, you know, that was his show.
That attention to detail.
Amazing attention to detail. I wasn't a dancer in the show, but just to watch how important just a finger was to that kind of work, it was great experience. Great experience.
You directed Joyce DeWitt in Gypsy.
Yeah.
Now, this excites me because you don't know how many times, and I say this without jest, how many times I have said to myself, I wonder what Joyce DeWitt is up to. And now I have a little window.
Yeah, this was maybe 10 years ago, I think. But she was Mama Rose. She was lovely. She did a lovely, lovely, lovely actress.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, she was just a really lovely lady. I heard she was here last week.
Right, I think with the comic convention, and I missed that.
Yeah.
I would have loved to knock on her door, you know, something. Can we call her? Are you in touch? Like, can we, like,
I'm
ring her?
I'm not in touch with her. I don't even have I just show up and tell her.
Now, Joyce DeWitt would make an interesting Peter Pan.
She would. She would. She would.
Maybe the next time you're asked to direct, you can be like,
yeah,
I know who we got to get. I mean, they'll still fly Kathy Rigby around, so
they
why not?
They still do. Yes, they certainly do. I think she may have retired. I'm not sure.
Oh, that won't stop her.
Yeah.
That won't stop the producers. You know, if we can fly her around again. What did you think of the live TV version they did of Peter Pan not too long ago?
What did I think of it? Well, let me say that I really admire all the people that were involved in it. And I admire the project itself. Because for somebody who makes their living completely in theater, live theater, anything that is done to whet the general public's appetite for wanting to go to a live show is a noble exercise, in my opinion. I may have done things a little differently, but, you know, I'm not... I don't feel like I'm in a place to criticize anybody, you know.
Right.
I think they put on a wonderful show, and people, you know, a lot of people tuned in, and that's the important thing. For as far as I'm concerned, what did you think of it?
You know, I didn't see it.
Okay,
but I saw clips, you know, and it's because, you know, and I saw little bits and pieces of when they did the Sound of Music one too.
Mm-hmm.
There's something very odd about that done live. You know, I think it's just maybe the filter on the cameras or something, but it just really is bizarre.
Well,
because it's not TV as we know it. It's not stagecraft as we know it. It's some weird in-between place.
Have you ever seen the original live one?
I was going to ask you, with Cyril Richard as Captain Hook. Yes, I was going to bring that up.
There's two of them. They did it in 1955 in black and white, and then in 60 they did it again, the exact same thing, only they had color cameras. So it's if you can look at a clip of either one, you see it's exactly the same. But I think that's where the live idea came from.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they basically with the Peter Pan, the 55 version and 60 version, they pretty much just took the stage version and they put three cameras and did it like they used to do television. The amount of work that it went into to produce this live version is just the split second timing that had to be exactly right. The camera, I mean, it was, the first one was pretty primitive if you look at it. I mean, there were close-ups and pans and good shots, but this was really, you could see that it took an enormous amount of work and coordination to put together, and right there you have to admire that they were able to do that.
I just always remembered Cyril Richard as Captain Hook, who was probably the least, shall we say, frightening or in any way masculine villain.
Which is, you know what, but that's kind of fun for Captain Hook. That's what he's supposed to be.
The curls and everything.
I don't want to give anything away, but there's even a particular stage direction in the original play that, what's the word that the author uses? Dandified, I think. He's, you know, at this particular point, this villain would become dandified, and he does. I think, I don't know if it's that word or not, but that's what I loved about that.
Well, that makes sense, because if you look at it, really, you're telling me this gang of brutal pirates can't take on this group of kids?
Yeah.
So it's that they're dandified about it, you know, they might stop and have tea first.
Have you ever seen there's another Peter Pan out there. It's a video version, a movie version with Danny Kaye and Mia Farrow.
Mm-mm.
Well, I watched that because I love to just see any version that I can see, basically to see if there's anything I can lift from it.
Yeah. Or be inspired by. Let's say that. I think
that. You're a theater person. You know, you probably know, and maybe a lot of people listening to this, but do also. But if you listen to this, it's the script is almost exactly the same as this version we're doing. The music is different. And it was done in England. And I was listening to the music, and I thought, Tim Hartman and I were talking about this the other day. I thought, that music is really familiar. It sounded familiar. The style sounded very familiar. And I looked at it at the end. I read the credits. It was Leslie Bricus wrote the score.
Oh.
And the lyrics by Anthony Newley. This was done like in the mid-70s, I think. Exactly where a song appears in this version, a song appears in that version. It's just a different song. And it's kind of interesting. But
good detective work there.
Yeah, well, only because I was going, God, that sounds familiar. And I've done Leslie Bricus' Scrooge, so I'm very familiar with his style of writing. And I thought, it's got to be Leslie Bricus. Sure enough, the name came up.
Good ear. Yeah. There you go. What is it about this story that makes it so timeless and that can transfer into several different, you know, performance media, stage, film, television?
I think it's the aspect of not wanting to grow up, wanting to be a perpetual boy. And there's two, when I work on the show, especially this time, I think there's two arcs we want to follow in the story. There's Peter's arc, who starts out a little boy and ends a little boy because he doesn't want to. And there's Wendy, who starts out a little girl, but somewhere along the line she realizes she's got to grow up. And that's that. In fact, the original story that this was based on was called Peter Pan and Wendy.
We forget about that.
Yeah, and I think Wendy is a very important element in the...
If I were her agent, I'd be speaking up about this.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, a little too little, too late.
Yeah, but it's but she's lovely, and we have a girl that is a student here actually playing Wendy, so that's really really cool.
So adults and children alike.
I think completely.
What can we expect from your production?
You can expect. That's great. That's an interesting one. Well, you can expect Peter Pan. You can expect a wonderful cast. And I hope that we really focus on telling the story of these two children. One doesn't want to grow up, and one. So that's, you know, it's Peter Pan.
Indeed. does that concept or that the idea of not growing up, was that one that appeals to you? Would you take that if a genie granted that to you?
Well, when I'm working with 20-year-old kids and looking at their bright eyes and their oh, it's great, especially at PMT. It's like a beehive here.
Yeah.
How positive they are, and remembering how I was back then. I think a lot about that now. Maybe, but ultimately, I don't think I'd want to go back. I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. That's an interesting question. You always look back and, for example, I look back and I go, well, if I wasn't so stuck on being an actor and I started directing or working to be a director at 21 instead of getting my equity card and being the third page from the left in Camelot with Rock Hudson, maybe I'd be farther along as a director.
Now, you can't just drop Camelot with Rock Hudson and like move on. I mean, I'm sure that's a story too. But, yeah,
he was King Arthur. It was 1977, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, 77. He played King Arthur.
Good for him.
Yeah. And the reason I even thought of that is I got an email a couple of weeks ago from an author that's doing a biography, and he was going through all the programs and found my name under, you know, third page from the left, and went to Equity and said, how can I contact these people? And I thought I'd talk about it. You know?
I wonder how long it's going to be before biographers start contacting me. About all, given all
the
dirt I know
on people. That's the first
time.
Well, you know, the story I told you about Bob Fosse, there's lots of books out there about him.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of people, but I've never heard or read about that story. Even the day that he passed away, there are certain things I remember vividly about that day that none of the other people who've written books that were sitting there with me remembered. So, who knows?
Maybe it's up to you.
To write it, yeah, I could write one about my... It would be an interesting book, I think.
Oh, I'm sure. And it's nowhere near over yet.
Yeah, I hope not. Who knows?
Well,
you know this business, though. I mean, you know. I've known this business since I was 19.
This is why we have martinis on the show.
Exactly.
And this is why they're very full.
Yes.
But we at Berg Vivant salute you and all that you do and to your upcoming production of Peter Pan with PMT.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to meet you.
Likewise.
Cheers. Mm-hmm.
In closing, we would like to once again thank our spectacular sponsors and strategic partners, Off the Wall Theater, Cefalo's Banquet and Events Center, Carnegie, Pennsylvania, Arcade Comedy Theater, Downtown, and Berg Vivant is a proud supporter of Firefly Arts, creating opportunities and support for families living with autism through innovative arts programming. Find out more and show your support at fireflyarts.org. And be sure to follow Pittsburgh's Cultural Talk magazine online. You can find Berg Vivant, the It in Pittsburgh, on Facebook, Twitter, or subscribe for free at www.bergvivant.com. This is Brian Edwards saying cheers and good night.